Got a companion up here. A wasp flying around. Not the one I want. Our scripture reading this morning is from the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 17, verses 19 through 58. One of the most well-known and, I suppose, beloved passages of scripture. Page 324 of the Old Testament section of the Pew Bibles. Before we hear from God's word, please pray with me. Sovereign Lord, let the words of your servant's mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. We ask this through Christ Jesus. Amen. So again, 1 Samuel 17, beginning at verse 19. Now Saul and they there refers back to Saul's brothers from the previous verses. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, took the provisions, and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the encampment as the army was going forth to the battle line, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage, ran to the ranks, and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. All the Israelites, when they saw the man, fled from him and were very much afraid. The Israelites said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. The king will greatly enrich the man who kills him and will give him his daughter and make his family free in Israel." David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" The people answered him in the same way, "So shall it be done to the man who kills him." His eldest brother Eliab heard him talking to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. He said, "Why have you come down? With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down just to see the battle." David said, "What have I done now? It was only a question." He turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no one's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are just a boy, and he has been a warrior from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father, and whenever a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, I went after it and struck it down, rescuing the lamb from its mouth. And if it turned against me, I would catch it by the jaw, strike it down, and kill it. Your servant has killed both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, since he has defied the armies of the living God." David said, "The Lord who saved me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will save me from the hand of the Philistine." So Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. David strapped Saul's sword over the armor, and he tried in vain to walk, for he was not used to them. Then David said to Saul, "I cannot walk with these, for I am not used to them." So David removed them. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the wadi and put them in his shepherd's bag in the pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. The Philistine came on and drew near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, And I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the wild animals of the field. But David said to the Philistine, you come to me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This very day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the Philistine army this very day to the birds of the air and to the wild animals of the earth, so that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not save by sword and spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. When the Philistine drew nearer to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag, took out a stone, slung it, and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, striking down the Philistine and killing him. There was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine. He grasped his sword, drew it out of its sheath, and killed him. Then he cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The troops of Israel and Judah rose up with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shaaraim as far as Gath and Ekron. The Israelites came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. When Saul saw David go out against Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this young man? Abner said, as your soul lives, O king, I do not know. The king said, inquire whose son the stripling is. On David's return from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant, Jesse, the Bethlehemite. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks
be to God. So here the Philistines are. Again, those words of the Lord that we are reminded of week in and week out about the inhabitants of the land who Israel did not utterly drive out of the land. Those words about them being as the barbs and the thorns, they were not, as it turned out, an empty threat. Those words were simply a prophetic pronouncement of reality. So it was only four chapters ago that we saw last Sunday in chapter 13, Saul and his army were surrounded by Philistines. And we saw Saul last Sunday, in his anxious fear, disobey the commandment of the Lord. And so we also heard Samuel, at the Lord's direction, say to Saul, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. And the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and this is the framework for the chapters that followed and leading up to this moment that we heard this morning. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. So then in those following chapters, we witness Saul kind of plunge on a downward spiral of arrogant disobedience. Kind of gets worse and worse as you go. He flagrantly disobeys the direct commands of Yahweh. He ends up setting up a monument to himself, even though really the work was obviously Yahweh's, but even through Jonathan more than himself. Saul just sets up a monument to himself instead of a monument to God. And the biblical scholar David Payne sums up Saul's situation like this. He says, the impression we gain is of a man out of touch with God's desires. That's a real nice way of putting it. And especially when we think of its contrast. So what is a man after God's own heart? We find Saul just becoming increasingly detached from the desires of God's heart. So then in the end of chapter 15, Samuel reconfirms what we heard in chapter 13 last Sunday. And he says to Saul, and again, this is after yet another direct disobedience of God's command. He says, "You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel." And then the narrator tells us, as Samuel turned to go away, Saul seized the skirt of Samuel's robe and he tore it. And Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord has torn the king." So you get this real graphic image, right? That robe being torn. Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you." So it's literally at that moment then, turn the corner from chapter 15 into chapter 16, that we see Samuel with his horn anointed with oil. He's heading off to anoint the next king of God's people. And he makes his way at the direct command of God, makes his way to Jesse, the Bethlehemite. And we hear the Lord tell Samuel, we watch, really, the Lord tells Samuel to pass over Jesse's son. He starts with Eliab, the oldest, and just works his way down the line until Jesse's forced to call in his youngest son, who isn't named yet, from the fields with the sheep. And the narrator again tells us, now this son, now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." And then Samuel took the horn of oil and he anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed on David. And that's the first time we hear his name. Rushed upon David from that day forward. And then we learn right in the next verses there that as the Spirit rushed on David, at that point the Spirit departs from Saul. And a harmful spirit from the Lord tormented him instead. Now, in the midst of that little moment there, by God's providence, it is discovered that David can play the harp. He can play the harp such that Saul is comforted from this spirit that torments him. And so it happens, kind of maybe a bit of foreshadowing there, David ends up in the kingly palace, the courts there, right, working in a temporary fashion in Saul's court. And now Saul, turn the corner into chapter 17. The king, who has already been rejected by Yahweh, finds himself once again face to face with the Philistines. Chapter 4, verse 17 tells us that there came up out of the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath, who we've obviously heard about. Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. That's about 9.5 feet, if you want to do the conversion. There's no reason to think that this was the stuff of legendary embellishment. There are also, we should trust it because it's the Bible, but there are also extra biblical accounts from ancient sources that describe similar giant warriors. And archaeologists have actually unearthed 2 females, skeletons, from the same time period that were actually 7 feet tall. So I don't know what they were drinking back then, but something was genetic, something was going on. So the way this worked then, you got this champion, he comes out, lines up. Champion warfare was, so you're using one person as a representative rather than using the whole army, right? But champion warfare was believed to discern what was the will of the gods, or whose gods were stronger, you might say. Now, I suppose when you've got a Goliath, you keep him on hand. He's a guy to keep on hand, right? You got a Goliath whose bronze armor itself weighed about 125 pounds. The tip of his spear, iron, he had bronze armor. Remember, you're in the transition here between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. His spear tip weighed about 15 pounds. So, you know, think about a big bowling ball at the end of your spear. When you got a guy like that around, it's probably a safe bet that you can usually go the route of champion warfare instead of involving your whole army. So the whole army gets to go out for their camping expedition. They get to do the hoorah stuff. They have a little bit of fun, but they don't have that annoying risk of death that usually accompanies it, because Goliath's going to win for you pretty much every time. So for 40 days, morning and night, Goliath comes out and he mocks the Israelites. "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. let him come down to me. And if he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. So he lays out the groundwork, kind of the contract between the two parties. He can kill me, then we'll be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you will be our servants and serve us. Today I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man. He wants a man that we may fight together. So actually in the verses preceding where we began this morning, the narrator is really working this up. This goes on for 40 days, morning and night. This guy comes out. The narrative is really setting this up. He wants us to see that in that long length of time, we're way past the point that Saul himself should have gone forward to fight. So this is actually, the narrator's painting a picture in which Saul is even further diminished. But instead of Saul going out to fight, we find that when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So it's into this scene of Saul's and Israel's shame, of Saul's and Israel's fear, into this scene walks the same David, a man of valor, a man of war, prudent in speech, and a man of good presence, as he was described. Kind of this guy was giving Saul his David's CV, you know, or maybe, you know, it's kind of acting as a reference for David when David was asking for somebody to play the harp, because you want your harp player to be a man of war and a man of valor. I mean, that's the kind of harp player you want around to calm your nerves. At any rate, that's the way he was described. That same David, who we saw Samuel anoint in the presence of his father and his brothers in chapter 16, he walks into this scene. Now, he's been sent by his father only to deliver some rations for his brothers who are in Saul's army. And remember, of course, they're in Saul's army, because we learned a few weeks ago that you're going to have a king like the other nations. Well, you're going to get a king like the other nations, and your sons are going to be conscripted into his army. So there they are. David gets sent to bring some rations. But in God's providence, this ration-delivering errand would set the stage for all that was to come. And I do mean all that was to come, like here and then way into the future. It would be the means by which the Lord would deliver his people again, here and way into the future. So just as David runs up to the ranks, and remember, there are no coincidences, there are no chance timings in God's world. Just as he runs up to the ranks, Goliath and Saul's army get ready to go through their daily rigmarole. Right? Goliath mocks them, threatens them. The Israelites flee from him in terror. Now, the men had been speculating about the reward that would come to the man who might actually finally kill Goliath. Riches, Saul's daughter as a bride, freedom for the man's family, likely meaning freedom from taxes and freedom from the commandeering of lands. Remember, they've got a king like the other nations now. Freedom from the conscription of sons, those kinds of things. And so when David is enlightened of the situation that confronts Israel's army, the men tell him of those possible rewards. So it's then, in that moment, that we meet the first of David's interactions that begin a certain kind of pattern that contain varying levels of disrespect or disdain for David. So this first instance, so this sets a pattern that's going to weave its way through the narrative. The first time is with David's oldest brother, Eliab. And really it consists of the normal stuff of an older brother angered, annoyed by his younger brother, and assuming the worst of intentions and motivations on the part of the younger brother. Now, that oftentimes can work the other way, too. Younger brothers can get annoyed and angry with older brothers and assume the worst about them. This lovely little scene, it's like anybody who's got siblings can immediately identify with what happens here. But you can imagine, right, how an older brother might feel if the kid brother somehow weaseled his way onto the sidelines of the big football game. You know, the older brother's there in his gear, and then this kid comes up and, like, how are you going to feel? And then the kid starts pestering all of the other players. Like, but this is not Eliab's and David's first rodeo. They've done this before, and they figured out how to work with one another. At least David's figured it out. He just ignores him, walks away, and starts talking to some other people. Younger brothers, that's a good plan. Just walk away. You're not going to win. Just walk away. So all of David's talk and questions get taken seriously, though. Not by Eliab, but by all the other men. All of David's talk gets taken seriously. And they actually tell Saul about it. And so Saul ends up calling for this guy David. Now, interestingly, David speaks first. The narrator doesn't have Saul ask David anything or say anything to David. Just David comes right out of the gates. He's the one speaking. He's the one clearly in charge here. And it might seem, given this context, that David speaks with kind of an odd mixture. Maybe it's not an odd mixture of naivety and confrontation. Let no one's heart fail because of him. He's talking about Goliath. No, let no one's heart fail because of Goliath. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Now, certainly, within the no one whose hearts are not supposed to fail because of Goliath is the heart of King Saul himself. So David, who's just been called out by his brother, who is himself nothing but a grunt in Saul's army, is now standing before the king, correcting the king, implying that the king is a coward, and telling the king to put away his fear. And it happens that David also believes that he can and that he should fight Goliath. He should be the guy. And the narrator doesn't give us a whiff of fear or reservation on the part of David. So now that pattern that was established by Eliab is going to now continue, and it shows up in Saul as well. So Saul responds with incredulity, and like Eliab, responds with a certain level of disrespect or disdain for David. You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you are just a boy, and he has been a warrior from his youth. Now, I would argue here that youth would be a better translation for the word that describes David rather than boy. The Hebrew word indicates a young man who is physically mature, but who is not of the age to be married or in the army yet. But it does refer to someone who's physically mature. And David's response here, actually, I think, drives that point home. That we're not dealing with a little boy. We're dealing with a young, physically mature man. So a physically immature boy, and we might be tempted to think of David in those terms because of the way this story most frequently gets retold and the pictures of it that show up in, you know, the children's Bibles. There's this little boy. So the way it's retold, and then that word boy in the Pew Bibles could lead us to view it that way. But a physically immature boy could not and would not fight with bears and lions. And hopefully, Jesse seems like a fairly decent father. He wouldn't send his physically immature son into situations in which he would have to fight with bears and lions. Likewise, there's no indication that the reason David chose not to use Saul's armor was because the armor was too heavy or too big for him. Both the narrator and David himself speak of his not being used to them. So the Hebrew word there means that it wasn't tested. David had not tested it. He had not tried it out. He had not trained with the armor. It's not that it was necessarily too big for him or too heavy for him. Moreover, the other men who brought word of David's questions and all of the talk that David was doing there in the line, they must have thought that there would be merit in bringing this guy before Saul in relation to his being able to fight for them. If David was a mere physically immature boy, he would have never been introduced to the king. If David was a mere boy, Saul would not have been swayed by David's stories about the lions and the bears. He would have said, this kid's making stuff up. And he certainly, if David was just a little boy, would not have tried to put his armor on him. So the real picture then, I'm just trying to correct some, you know, misconceptions about the story of David here. The real picture here is of a strong young man, a strapping lad, we should say, who simply does not have military experience at this point. Now, not that that dramatically alters the situation. He's still a normal guy, right? Maybe about my height or something, maybe a bit bigger. It doesn't really matter. He could be a foot taller than me. He'd still be 2.5 feet short of a literal Goliath. who is not only huge, but also has vast military experience. But if we go down this rabbit hole, we're actually playing into the expectations of everyone here. If we think in those terms, we will be thinking like literally everybody in the story, with the exception of David himself. That's kind of the point. Israel wanted a king like the other nations. They got a king like the other nations. Saul had the same kind of vision as the kings of the other nations. I should have named this sermon series titles something about having the right kind of sight. Saul counted men and chariots and swords and spears, like all of the other kings. When Saul saw Goliath, he could only measure Goliath's 9.5 feet and then the muscle mass that accompanied it. And when Saul looked at himself, all he could do was calculate the difference. When Samuel went to David's father, Jesse, Samuel did the same thing with David's brothers. He measured them for size, acting like a tailor who was sent by the Lord to make new suits for David's brothers or something, rather than to come as a prophet and a judge and anoint God's next king. As Samuel was struggling to alter his expectations rather than their suits. Did you get that? It was a tailor pun. A bad dad pun. As Samuel was struggling to alter his expectations, Yahweh said to him, "The Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." And it's almost like David, man after God's own heart, looks at things with eyes more in tune with the way God sees. And so throughout all these chapters, the narrator is inviting us to see David in contrast to Saul. David is going to have significant faults and failures of his own. We know that. But there is a real difference here. And so something is being established that's going to move forward and that will be fulfilled later on. We'll get to that later. And later. It's just that David, when he looked at Goliath, he saw Goliath's vast height. He saw his strength. It's not like David didn't see Goliath for what he was. It's just that David knew Goliath's height and strength did not matter in this context. There's going to this line for champion warfare. Doesn't matter here. This is champion warfare in which the victory would reveal not the strength of the champion, but the victory would reveal the will of the gods. Or as David knew, it would reveal the will and the might of the one true living God. Goliath might be 9.5 feet tall, guy you don't want to meet in the dark alleys of Gath, outside of this context. But here on this field of battle, in which this man had been openly defying the living God for 40 days, no. In this context, he's merely an oversized, blundering representative of deaf, dumb, blind idols, lifeless idols. As such, it didn't really matter who stepped forward for Israel, because they would step forward the representative of the one true living God. Whoever steps forward to Israel, he's going to win. David saw with different eyes. He saw the unseen but the true and living God, and he knew that God, the same Lord who had saved David from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he knew that that God was bigger and stronger and would save him and save Israel again. Everyone else there, including all of the Israelites and Israel's king Saul, they were thinking like Goliath. They were assuming Goliaths in the Philistines' whole framework. All of their categories, all of their assumptions about the way the world works. The Israelites had indeed become like the nations. They were acting then like the people of lifeless, powerless gods. as they fled in fear. David, though, was not acting like the other nations at this moment. He was remembering God's past saving actions for himself. His repeated assertion that God is the living God means that he was also remembering God's past saving actions for Israel. So it's no surprise that as Israel's champion, David would remove the armor and look different from the other nation's champion. It's going to look different. In this moment, he looks like a shepherd with his staff and his bag full of stones and his sling. As they draw up to one another, David meets that pattern. Remember, he meets disdain and disrespect again, this time from Goliath. Am I a dog that you would come at me with sticks? It's a reference to David's shepherd staff. And the Philistine, the narrator, tells us, cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the wild animals of the field. Now, this kind of trash talking is recorded in the literature of the ancient world in accounts of champion warfare. And it's kind of an expected part of the show. You know, it's not unlike the trash talking that happens in the days leading up to the heavyweight championship fight. I'm going to flutter like a butterfly and sting like a bee, that kind of thing. Whatever it is, it still happens today. Goliath's own speech is relatively short in comparison to David's speech. And David goes through a bit more. He acknowledges the discrepancy in their armament. Yep. You've got your sword and your spear and your javelin, and you see that I've just got my little stick here. And commentators point out that it seems like Goliath, some of the commentators actually even talk about the fact that along with giantism often comes vision problems. Anyway, but the commentators point out the fact that Goliath failed to see the weapon that David had in his possession, that Goliath might have actually been more wary of. So he missed the sling, right? He talked about the stick. He evidently didn't see the sling. The sling was a legitimate military weapon of David's day. In the right hands, it was a very effective one. The book of Joshua points to this reality, the effectiveness of the sling in the context of the conquest. It describes the mustering of the tribes of Benjamin. And it says, among all these were 700 chosen men who were left-handed. I don't know if you can sling a sling better if you're left-handed, kind of like pitchers, they're preferred to be left. I don't know what the deal is. But 700 chosen men who were left-handed, every one could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. So it's a legitimate military weapon. And perhaps Goliath might have had a slightly different view of things had he seen the sling. But David continues his own trash talking and reveals not the weapon, but rather the true champion that Goliath did not see. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Goliath had not been merely defying the armies of Israel, not just the king of Israel or the people of Israel, but the God of Israel. The God who is Yahweh of hosts, the God who led Israel out of Egypt and buried Pharaoh's army under the waters of the sea. And remember, and this is what David's remembering. Israel did not even have an army when Yahweh defeated Pharaoh. And Moses did not have a single thing, not even his staff in his hand, when the chariots of Pharaoh were defeated. The Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand. All it was a hand. Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen. The Israelites only had trumpets in their hands when the walls of Jericho fell. How many times did Israel witness God overcome their enemies without their needing to touch any weapon at all? Because Yahweh threw into confusion the enemies of Israel, and they ended up destroying themselves. What did it matter what David had in his hands when he came in the name of the Lord of hosts? And then David speaks calmly in return of the way he sees things playing out. So Goliath had his own vision of the way things were going to turn out. David calmly replies, this is not just going to result in the death of you, Goliath. And then with some precision, he details how it's going to play out with his cutting his head off, even though David didn't have a sword. It's actually going to result in the death of the Philistine army too. The whole army. The interesting thing about David's trash talking is that he gives a rationale. There's a so that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that Yahweh does not save by sword and spear. Now, we obviously need to note that David is not interested in his own glory at all, or even in the glory of Israel. He's only interested in the glory of Yahweh of hosts. But we should also note that while trash talking, David frames what he knows will be a victory, he frames it such that it will have theological significance. I love this. He's doing theology when he's trash talking. This is the way it should be done. It's going to have significance, and it's going to have significance for the whole earth. Theological significance. The covenant God of Israel is not, and is not supposed to be, a regional or a tribal God of just one people. And going all the way back to that covenant with Abraham, I mean, David's remembering back, he's doing theology. God is supposed to be and will be the one true God for all the peoples of the earth. Through you, all the peoples of the earth will be blessed. And they'll be blessed because the one true God is their God, and in no other way. The second part, the Lord does not save by sword and spear, comes as a warning to Goliath and the Philistines, and it comes as a reminder to the Israelites. David's trash talking here is not just for Goliath. He is proclaiming to the whole assembly. That means Goliath's side, and that means his own side. Israelites are included in this. They need to be reminded of the reality that they've completely forgotten. And that they need to be reminded that they need to have eyes to see what, or rather who, truly lies before them. They need to be reminded of what he is capable. Goliath remains unconvinced. Remember, he's got this certain kind of vision. All he can see is the shepherd before him. He doesn't see the God who the shepherd serves. And so Goliath slowly draws near to meet David. And David, who is unencumbered by armor or by doubt, runs to meet him, takes the stone out of the bag, slings it, strikes the Philistine in the one place that the blow would take him down. It's almost like the whole event from the first of it, when David initially runs up to the line, was guided by the hand of God as this young man who he has anointed to be his king comes on the public scene for the first time. It was providentially guided, the whole of it. Being delivered into his hand by God, David fulfills the rest of the promise he made to Goliath. I will strike you down and cut off your head. Rather humiliating, he gets his head cut off by his own sword. And though the Philistine army was not true to Goliath's word, because Goliath had said, if he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. So they should have at that moment surrendered to Israel. They don't. They flee instead. But then the rest of David's words also come true. I will give the bodies of the Philistine army this very day to the birds of the air and to the wild animals of the earth. Friends, though it's almost universally said that this is, it is not really the story of David and Goliath. We hear this probably even in the Bible. If you've got a little note, it says right before chapter 17, David and Goliath. It's not the story of David and Goliath. This is really not at all, even though it's depicted that way, it's not the greatest underdog story in the history of all underdog stories. In fact, the way the narrator and the way David himself tells the story, this is not an underdog story at all. This is the story of Yahweh, the Lord of hosts, and Goliath. The narrator sees and David sees, and they want us to see, not David, whatever strength or lack of strength he might have had. They want us to see, rather, the living God who saves. That was the whole rationale, right? David listed the rationale out there. The point isn't that you see me, David. The point is that you see the living God. Our eyes should be focused on the living God alone. We should see that Goliath and all the world's giants who have set themselves in opposition to the living God are the completely outclassed underdogs. So my family likes to watch Hoosiers every fall. You know that story of the little Indiana basketball team that goes all the way to the state championships, and there's a scene there that the pastor walks into the room and tells the story of David and Goliath, because here they are, these little underdogs, right? No, I hate to burst your bubble if you find yourselves rooting for an always outclassed athletic team. And you're always hoping for some David and Goliath story. This is a story in which the underdog loses. Goliath is the underdog. This is a story of God working. He's working providentially through all of Saul's rebellion. And in this moment, David's obedience. He's working to provide the family line that would lead finally to another champion. Another champion, as it turns out, from Bethlehem. Who would line up face to face with all of the world's giants. And the giants, Satan himself, our own sinful rebellion, death, all of death's friends. They had been warned all those years ago. The Lord does not save by sword and spear. The battle is the Lord's. Indeed, friends, God our champion from the line of David would forego not only spear and sword, he would also forego sling and rock and every other form of armament. He would, in the end, be himself pierced by sword and spear. And that is wherein our victory, his victory, is found. That's what this story is about. This is the story of God's victory. The story of the God who works and works and works all the way to Bethlehem again. May we have the eyes to see the living God who saves. Amen.